chance of some morning snow with a high of 40, 45 on Sunday, 56 on Monday, 61 on Tuesday. Here are the current numbers. It is 29 degrees in Racine, 28 in Kenosha, 24 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Some scattered flurries in the air. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andreas, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning today's morning show with, first of all, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Neil Sharnick, assistant professor of theater, and Christian Aldridge, who is here in the studio. He is a senior theater major at Carthage, and we're going to be talking about a world premiere, which occurs at Carthage this coming weekend, a brand new play called Breath of Stars by Karadad Svich. This is the eighth installment in a really exciting undertaking at Carthage called the Carthage New Play Initiative, in which, as the name suggests, a number of brand new works have been created for the Carthage Theater Department and receiving their world premiere on the campus of Carthage. In this particular case, Breath of Stars is a startlingly new play, but based on something very old and beloved, namely The Tempest by William Shakespeare. At least some of the characters are shared with Shakespeare's Tempest. We're going to explore some of the ways in which this play evokes Shakespeare's original, but goes off into some very, very intriguing new directions. Neil Sharnick, in addition to being assistant professor of theater and director of this world premiere production, is also the new director of this new play initiative at Carthage. So we'll spend a few minutes talking about that as well, and about the excitement that is a part of having students be a part of something as groundbreaking as a world premiere. Neil Sharnick and Christian Aldridge, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Good to have both of you here. So, Neil Sharnick, talk for a moment, first of all, about the New Play Initiative, what you know about how that began, and what kind of difference you think that has made in the artistic landscape at Carthage in the theater department.
Well, sure. About a decade ago, when Professor Herschel Kruger was in charge of the department, the department expanded. It expanded its season. We rewrote the curriculum. There was some significant growth and improvement happening in the department. And the growth necessitated bringing in guest directors, bringing people in occasionally to support the work that we were doing, because the faculty, the ambition overreached the capacities of the faculty a little bit. So we started bringing in guest artists every year, usually guest directors. But the opportunity arose to commission a new work by Eric Simonson, who is a Wisconsin native, member of the Steppenwolf Ensemble, an Academy Award-winning short filmmaker, Tony-nominated director, a really exciting person. His play Lombardi, a lot of your listeners may know, was on Broadway. So when that opportunity presented itself, obviously we jumped at the chance, and that would be the first play in what would later become the New Play Initiative. I had an opportunity the following year to commission my dissertation advisor, actually, in Madison, Aparna Darwadkar, to commission a new translation of an existing modern Hindi classic, One Day in the Season of Rain, which became the second play in the initiative, the only translation rather than 48 play. And then from then on, we realized we really had something special going, and that these opportunities that these plays had presented were something other colleges could not offer, something our students really truly valued, the opportunity to work closely with a writer to premiere a role, to perhaps premiere a design. We've had student designers working on these shows as well. To see the process as a new work develops, to workshop it, to develop it. At this point, two of them now have traveled abroad. Claymore Brooks opened at Smock Alley in Dublin. No Name went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So the program just gets bigger and bigger. And this play, in fact, is scheduled to travel to Arezzo, Italy this summer to participate in the Crisis Art Festival there. So it's just onward and upward for this program, and we're very excited to see this keep going for this foreseeable future.
Do these plays, generally speaking, take shape well ahead of the casting? I guess another way to ask this question is to what extent, if at all, are these plays crafted with Carthage and its particular company of student actors in mind? Or, generally speaking, could these plays just as well be written for the theater students at Parkside or the theater students at Marquette or wherever?
Well, that's a great question. There's been a real diversity of levels of interaction with the playwright and different chronologies. Some of the plays have been profoundly written for and about Carthage. When Rick Cleveland, who's play Five Presidents was premiered at the Milwaukee Rep last year. When we commissioned him to write a play for us, he wrote this play called The Rail Splitter that was about a small Midwestern college with a tie to Abraham Lincoln. Like it was very clearly in which a playwright was commissioned to write a play and decided to write a play about Abraham Lincoln. So he made it this sort of mockumentary comedy, right? But it very much about the characters. In fact, I recently went and saw an alumnus of ours, Bree Below, up at First Stage, and I noticed that in her bio she mentioned playing a character named Bree Beloff in The Rail Splitter. The role was written for Bree Below, and the character is named Bree Beloff. There's no question that that character was written for her, absolutely, with her in mind.
So sometimes that's the case. Is that up to the playwright, or is it just sort of life circumstances that determine whether that collaboration will occur in that way or in a more sort of generic fashion?
Yeah, it is. You know, when we approach the playwright, sometimes we are able to say, what do you have in your mind? Write that play for us. We want to do it. You know, there's an advantage to these playwrights. The industry is such right now that if you write a play for about more than four actors, there aren't a lot of theaters interested in doing it just because of the economy of it. And we say, hey, if you have an idea with 20 actors, write that play. We'll do that. We'd love to do that because we'd love to get more students involved. You know, if it has all these elaborate sets, we'll do it. We want that opportunity, and we want to give you that opportunity. So that's been an attractive selling point, I think, with some of the playwrights. The only stipulation, remember, you're writing for college age kids. One of the problems college theater sometimes has is there are a lot of great plays out there, but not many that don't have elderly characters or characters that aren't perfect roles for our students. So we can actually ask for a play, if all the characters are college age, that would be great. These characters can actually be playing, these actors can be playing appropriate roles for themselves. So we're able to create good plays for our students, whether they're written specifically for them or not. They're written for college students, the roles are. And sometimes it's a much closer tie than that. With Caridad, the process actually began secretly before we even announced her as the new playwright for this year. Last year, she asked to get some information from our students. She just wanted to sort of get the pulse of the campus. So she asked questions about all sorts of things, from environmental issues to, there were all sorts of things. And just we put a little survey out in our lobby and put a little treasure chest with a nod to Prospero's Island, I suppose, and just let people, the students fill out the surveys and drop them in the chest, and we sent everything out to Caridad so she could just get a better sense. Since she's the first New York playwright we've commissioned. Most of them have been Chicago-based. One or two have been LA-based. So she's the first Chicago or New York playwright. She wasn't here as much, but she wanted some information. She wanted to get to know our students a little bit. So we did that for her.
Generally speaking, and then talk about this in particular, how has the process been in terms of responding to what a playwright gives you? Generally speaking, do you just do what they write, or is it more of a collaborative process in which you say, you know, this, I'm not sure this is going to work. I think this might be a little too complicated for our audience, or in whatever way, a little more than our production or our actors are going to be able to deliver. I mean, is it, generally speaking, ever a collaborative experience in that way?
It is, but as far as developing the script, that's up to them. Christian could maybe speak to when Jeffrey Hatcher wrote No Name for us. I know he showed up several times throughout the process to watch rehearsal, to rewrite, to make revisions. Mm-hmm. That has not been the case with Caradon. And in fact, she did email me at one point and say, so what sort of experience do you have working with projection? I think was one of the questions. And I said, well, we don't, but make it require projections and we will figure out how to work with projections. So this play, maybe more than any other I've ever worked on, has pushed our technical team to adopt new technologies, to try new things, and to really challenge ourselves and dream and imagine what this show could look like, and then figure out afterwards how to actually realize that.
So, Christian, you've been involved in at least one other world premiere as part of this new play initiative. So mm-hmm. What's been your experience in terms of the playwright and interaction with him or her as the play takes shape?
Well, the two projects of the new play initiative that I've been involved with are No Name by Jeffrey Hatcher and this current project, Breath of Stars. And they've been two vastly different processes as far as that goes. As Neil mentioned, over the course of the process with No Name, a couple of years ago, Jeffrey Hatcher would fly in periodically and watch a rehearsal or two, before we even started rehearsals, would be doing readings with before the show was even cast, just the students who wanted to be involved in a reading, to really get a feel for, you know, his words, and every time we saw it, there were new edits. Even up until, I think, just before Tech Week for that production, we had some little changes in dialogue, and we got to talk to him about how these characters, you know, operated with each other, or specific questions we had about the script. And this play has been different in that we haven't, we talked with Caridad at the beginning of the process, and we had a lot of questions worked out then because we had the script for a little while. Now we're, at least as a cast member, I don't know how much, you know, Neil has been going back and forth with Caridad, although I would assume it's been quite a bit. We're sort of working with the script that we've had for quite a while now. And given her style of writing in this particular piece, which is without much in the way of stage direction and without anything in the way of written and specified characters, lines for each character, a lot of our process has been about deciding for us, for our production, how these words are set, how these images are presented, and how these characters, which we have to specify on our own, interact with each other.
So it's a very open-ended work in that respect. It leaves a lot to you and to Neil as your director.
It very much does. I can imagine this perhaps at another, if it were to have appeared at another school or at another venue, I think it would be a very different play. I think it is totally dependent upon, as it exists now, the minds of the cast and the director and the production team that are working on it with, you know, this specific production, which is very cool.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Neil Sharnick and Christian Aldridge, director and one of the actors for a world premiere, which occurs at Carthage College this weekend with performances the following weekend as well, of a brand new play called Breath of Stars by the Obie Award-winning playwright Caridad Switch. This is the eighth installment in something called the Carthage New Play Initiative. Professor Sharnick, we might as well not put off this challenge any longer. It's time to ask you to explain to our listeners the story of Breath of Stars, which I know is no small matter, based loosely on Shakespeare's Tempest, but taken taken into some very intriguing sort of modern areas. How would you summarize the story of Breath of Stars?
Yeah, well, one of the things that really excited me about Karadzhevich and her writing and encouraged me to seek her out as someone we'd want to work with is that she has written other plays that begin with classic tales, often with Greek mythology. She has a play rooted in Hamlet as well, but that really just uses those plays, those familiar myths and texts, as a springboard into a much more contemporary, much more modern exploration. And that's definitely what we have here. The characters, Ariel, Prospero, Miranda, Caliban, Sycorax, names familiar to your listeners who know and love The Tempest, are here, but the play is set in a very modern, in the digital age, and the problems and the issues and the world they live in is very much our world. So the play begins with Ariel sitting alone, scrolling through Facebook, as so many of us do, and she's specifically looking at the Facebook wall of Prospero, who is gone, who's no longer with us. So it's become sort of a shrine or an altar to him. And as again, as people who know The Tempest know, Prospero is a wizard. So things are not exactly as they seem. And the play begins more or less after a reflection on how messed up our world has become and wishing he were here and could do something about it. We find out he is, or part of him is in any case, that there is, that this, whether it's the Facebook and Twitter and Instagram feeds and everything that are keeping him alive, obviously in memory, he is there still in some way and is able to reach out to her and draws her into the world where he is now, into this cyber world. So definitely not The Tempest. We're not stuck on a desert, shipwrecked on an island. Though, as the play points out at one point, we are on an island. The play's, she's in Manhattan, right? But it's a different kind of island. It's not enchanted. At least it's not enchanted in the same way. And I don't want to give too much about what happens in terms of the plot beyond that. But what I want to say, for me, what has been most thrilling and exciting is both the just beautiful, the profound language of the play. Karadot is a dramatic poet in the truest sense. What she's written for us to say and work with is truly lovely. And she, on the first title page of the play, she refers to this as an invitation to dream, as her note to the production team. As Christian mentioned, the play script never says who's saying what line. It's just written as poetic text. And we had to figure that out. We had to assign things and really figure out what's actually happening on stage while these words are being said or projected or sung or whatever is happening with them. So the process has been, I think, the most exhausting, but also the most exciting and invigorating and creative that I've ever been a part of, that we really get to this raw material to springboard us into creative engagement.
Right. It sounds like I should think one of the biggest challenges here is how to craft this production so, in a sense, it makes sense to the audience, and so they can experience this with at least some sense of clarity. And of course, it would be possible to do this, to create this production, and not think very much about that at all, and just make it as beautiful as you could, and it could be a completely exhilarating and satisfying experience for your actors, but leaving the audience completely dumbfounded. I suspect you have had at least some concern about the audience and how they would experience this. What has that, in fact, been like?
Yeah, I've had lots of concern about that along the way. You know, when you're producing experimental theater off Broadway, your audience knows what they're getting when they come into the room, right? But Carthage Theater audiences, that's not necessarily the case, and they're not necessarily accustomed to worrying less about clarity and thinking about the play. But I was nervous about that at the beginning, but as the play has developed, and as you know, we've been able to do designer runs and bring everybody back in the room and start bringing the crew in, that really has not come up again. I've been really pleased and satisfied by the response that those seeing it for the first time now, later in the process, there really hasn't been any question about, okay, so what happened there, or what was going on? I think that the storytelling is pretty clear. Now there are things that are metaphor, and one could ask at the end of the whole thing, now did that really happen? Did he really come to life in the computer, or was that her memory? Was that all sort of imagined? You're welcome to have those thoughts, but that's just because it's a interesting play. I don't think that has. I think it has deliberately left some room for question, but I don't think that's a fault at all. I think that's part of its beauty and its strength.
Hmm. Christian, what's been your experience as one of the actors in the play when it comes to the matter of sort of understanding even yourself as an actor, what's going on right here at this moment, and also thinking about what this experience is going to be like for the audience? I mean, what kind of a process has it been?
Well, it's as the rest of the process has been, it's been incredibly interesting, and especially Prospero, if you're a Shakespeare fan, is a legendary character to get to work with, and in this being such a different such a branch off from that, was sort of a wild ride at first, but you get down to as an actor, what makes the characters human, like what makes Prospero, and there's not much that's confusing in the way of that. Like when you get down to it, and how we had some wonderful moments of clarity with this in the past couple of rehearsals, asking questions about how Prospero feels about the situation that he's in with the start of the play. And how he feels about Ariel and the other Ariel and these characters that he are part of his life and afterlife. It's just been it's like working with any other character with a couple of extra opportunities to just as Caridad writes to dream, to sort of imagine what it what this has to be like. It's a little more. A little more creative than maybe a role that you've seen before,
Right.
And that's been a very cool thing to work with.
Yeah, I bet it's been hugely satisfying for you as an actor to have that kind of experience. We're joined by Marie Treadway, who is also part of the cast. She is portraying the role of Sycorix.
Yes.
And maybe you could say a quick word about what that experience has been like for you. What has it been like to be part of that? Pull that mic a little closer
sure.
to you.
So Sycorax is a woman in a hospital who has lost her memory entirely. And so she remembers bits and pieces of it, but it's also other people's memory. So she's kind of fabricating her own memory in a sense. And she evokes memories of a Roseland Grand Ballroom and the golden age of ballroom dancing, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers kind of style. She remembers bits and pieces about her childhood, but not necessarily her childhood, bits and pieces from things maybe she's read or recalled. So it's been really interesting as an actress to play somebody who has no idea who they are.
Right.
And the person who is double cast as me plays this memory of me that I've come up with in my mind with other people's experiences. So it's definitely a different departure how you would play a regular character and try to figure out her background, because Sic Rex doesn't have a background.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And I suspect you've never played a character exactly like this ever before.
No, not at all. I don't think anybody has ever, any of the cast has ever played these characters before. It was scary at first, especially in our training when we were based in Stanislavski of who are we playing against, who are we, what is our objective, and we had to kind of throw all of that out of the window and think of these characters more as entities, kind of who we embody and the spirits that they possess, as opposed to what exactly is the action in the scene. And it's wildly liberating after a while, scary at first, but it's been a great process.
Very well put. Neil, we're just about out of time, but say a quick word about the technical challenges of bringing this sort of cyber realm to life with projections and so on. I suspect that has been a huge part of the challenge of making this production come to life.
It has. Our colleague, Martin McClendon, actually, he created a J-term course this past January to explore digital technologies, projection technologies, image morphing and warping technologies, all sorts of things in order to support this play. And I think if that class hadn't existed, we'd be in deep water right now because the team that he created out of that class has done a great deal. We're operating 4 projectors. The set is largely these projected images. And we're finding interesting ways to have live actors interact with video, with image projection, with in ways that Carthage Theater has never done that before. Of course, we've used a projector here and there, but never on this scale and never with the necessity of precision, right? That we really interact with what's being projected and not just, project an image. So that's been exciting, and just to see the new there's so much is possible right now, and also because so much of this play has to do with the world, the way we sort of live this mediated life through social media, through whatever else, right? We have all these friends who we don't actually know very well, but they're our friends because they say they are on Facebook, and someone posts something about needing, about having lost someone they love, something sad, and we don't know what to do. Like, do we send an e-card, or is that shabby? Or, like, I don't really even know you, but I feel like I need to do something for you. So just sort of dealing with that new way of interacting with the world and with each other that's mediated through these technologies. And because the play deals with that reality, it seemed important to us to really enter into that fully, and commit to using these technologies. People, when they arrive, the pre-show, they're actually being asked to tweet things out to us on their phones. They're actually told, you don't have to shut off your phone for this play. Silence it, please. But there actually are ways we want the audience to be engaged to that level. And I think the world of AC, though strangely stylized, I think will be pretty familiar to them as the world we live in today.
Fascinating. So there are performances this weekend and the following weekend. What do people do if they're interested in getting tickets?
Right. There are shows this Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 3. And next weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the 10th, 11th, and 12th, all at 7:30. People can email theater tickets, that's theater with an R-E, tickets at carthage.edu to reserve their seats. They can call our box office at 262-551-6661 or stop by our box office in the Strata Center at Carthage.
Neil Sharnick is assistant professor of theater at Carthage and the director of this production of the world premiere of Breath of Stars by Kara Dadzvich, Christian Aldridge, and Marie Treadway, two of the cast members. Thank you to all of you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Greg.
And now we turn our attention from a brand new play receiving its world premiere to a towering classic from over a century ago, an important and controversial play by Norway's greatest playwright Henrik Ibsen, Hedda Gabler, being performed this weekend and the next at the University of Wisconsin Parkside under the direction of guest artist Brian Gill. I think it's really, really exciting that Parkside is taking on this play called Hedda Gabler, which I've heard of but never seen, and I really look forward to experiencing it in person. Did you have anything to do with it being chosen, or with you being the director of it, except, you know, accepting the challenge? Or, I mean, were you at all a catalyst in this appearing in this season?
No way was I involved in the selection of the play. I was when I was hired, the season was already decided, and I think, luckily and happily, jumped at the opportunity to be back at Parkside, but also to take on one of my favorite quote unquote classical playwrights. I'm an odd man, Greg, and I really love Henrik Ibsen's voice. Now, I mean, it's a translation, so I don't speak the original language. So, you know, a proximity maybe, but that really distinctive troublemaker who writes these great plays that kind of force us to look at things that we're very much aware of, but we just, even now, 100-some-odd years later, we don't particularly like to talk about out loud and in mixed company.
Right. And, of course, if we don't now, we can hardly imagine these things being talked about ever, even behind closed doors back in 1891, which is, I think, when Hedda Gabler was first seen. Ahead of us talking specifically about the play and its story, tell us something about Norway's greatest playwright. What's important for us to know about him and his legacy?
You know, he was really the revolutionary dirty old man of the theater. He would take on these topics, you know, that people really didn't want to look at. Inequality and infidelity in marriage, hypocrisy in our leaders, political and religious, and inequality of the sexes. That's a major thing in Hedda. You know, what happens when the smartest person in the room is a woman in a time when that's just not really okay? And she has many, many, many flaws. But I came at this from the point of view of she's deeply and profoundly frustrated. It is not a fair world. I mean, it's not a fair world in general, but it's she is controlled. She is a second class citizen because of the time, and yet she has this great wit and intellect, and she wants to play with the boys, but she's never allowed to play with the boys. And what happens when somebody of that sensibility and passion is essentially caged? And how does the idealist survive in a realist's world? And Ibsen would argue that they don't.
How typical is this work compared to other things that Ibsen wrote? I mean, was he making a really distinctive statement, unlike the statements made in anything else he created? Or is this, in a sense, typical of what he was about as a playwright, especially?
I think, well, his big three, you know, the ending of Western civilization as we know it came about with Doll's House, Ghosts, and Enemy of the People. And, you know, with Doll's House, it's the spoilers, but the end of the play, the young lady leaves her husband and children because she realizes that to stay would be a death sentence. And she is just that. She has spent her life being a doll in a doll's house. And, of course, get the torches and the pitchforks, because now suddenly Ibsen is advocating a woman's right to do what is best for her instead of suffering in silence, hanging on in quiet desperation kind of a thing. And I think, you know, there are elements of that in Hedda, you know, the battle of the sexes and where your place is, especially if you are a woman. But you can imagine with all of these plays, I mean, my imagination goes to the place of, you know, I can hear the audible gasps of several hundred people in a theater when, you know, when Hedda just carries on. And she is, you know, she's being a holy terror, but she's really not. She is trying to be her own person.
Mm. In a way, that, again, that would be truly shocking in 1891 and is still, to some extent, even shocking today. We should say something about kind of the kernel of the story of Hedda Gabler. As I understand it, as the play begins, she is, I think, newly married.
Yes.
And quite unhappily married. Although it's probably important to say that it's not that she's married to a monster, but she's married to someone who does not make her happy and is in a situation in a marriage that does not make her happy. Talk about Hedda's unhappiness within this marriage.
Well, and she states in the play when another character, a friend of hers, the judge, essentially says, you know, why on earth did you get married then if you're so unhappy? And she says, I had danced my last dance, Judge. Mm. She feels or felt that she stayed at the party just a little bit too long, and the young suitors weren't paying her as much attention as they used to. And then this young academic professor and researcher started to pursue her, and I think it may have seemed like she didn't have any options. She knew the judge was unattainable. Her previous relationship with the writer, and I always kind of think of him as a Byron-esque kind of bad boy poet, you know, Eilert Loveborg, tanked, and he has been gone for many, many years. And so I think that fear of, and again, it's an odd concept for us to think about, fortunately, in this fascinating modern age we live in. But a young woman who is no longer, quote unquote, young and is not married. And where do you go from that? Right. You know, you've got two options. You can be a spinster or you get married. Mm. And her father's long gone. She's the daughter of a general. And there are allusions in the text that he was quite a force of nature. So what happens when the major influence, male influence in your life, is this larger-than-life militaristic superhero, and you find yourself alone in a house with a bookworm?
Right. Who doesn't interest you all that
exactly.
much.
Exactly, yeah.
And, of course, what complicates the story then for Hedda is that at some point, and it sort of looks like it's fairly early in the story, she ends up reconnecting, re-encountering with this previous lover that you met, someone very, very gifted but very troubled. Do I remember? He's
absolutely
kind of an alcoholic.
Very troubled. He is a raging alcoholic who has been clean and sober for several years, but succumbs to to the siren song of society again. Mm. He's been out, you know, in the provinces as a tutor. Mm. And has gotten sober and has written a book while out there that has then gotten published, and everyone's now starting to take notice of him again. And again, in Ibsen's time, a second chance was almost impossible.
Hmm.
If you blew it, you blew it. And if you fell, you fell hard.
Forever.
Exactly. And that idea that is in a lot of Ibsen's plays, the shock and terror of what will the neighbors say?
Hmm.
You know, what will society say? So he has now come back and is in part succumbs to his desire for Hedda, but I think also he's called back, that siren song. It's easy to behave yourself when there are no temptations.
Hmm. And I suppose the fact that he has, in a sense, recreated himself or managed to create the second chance for himself probably is something of an inspiration to Hedda, that maybe she doesn't have to settle for what feels like a really unhappy and unfair lot for herself.
And she's, you know, she's really fascinating because she flat out says to him that she will not cheat on her husband. She's not going down that road. She loves to flirt. She loves the excitement of it. I think anything that reminds her of being a young woman in her father's home in which there was constant entertainment and they were constantly entertaining. There's a reference that she would go riding with her father. She's desperate for a horse again. You know, that in itself is kind of scandalous, this idea of a young woman riding free, you know, out in the wilderness on a horse. You know, I don't think so. She is trapped in a cage of her own making in some ways.
Do I remember correctly that her former lover now is married, and that one of the things that sort of drives Hedda crazy is jealousy about what her lover has with his wife?
Yes, he's not married. He has developed a relationship with a young woman named Thea, who, here's where it gets complicated. She is desperately unhappily married to a provincial governor or some sort of just kind of mean old man.
So she and Eilert are having an affair then?
It is alluded to. Okay. It's never said in that way, but she certainly is in love with him. And she has helped him write this new book that no one has seen yet, that is, the play gives you the feeling that it is going to be the greatest book of the 19th century.
Hedda is jealous of that collaboration.
She's jealous of everything. You know, she went to school with Thea, and Thea was timid and kind, and not to say that Hedda doesn't have moments of kindness, but Hedda was better looking and smarter and bolder and brasher, which again, no. But Hedda is desperate. She sees men all around her with the power to control other people's lives. And she is constantly reminded of her inability to do so. And then Thea and Lovborg come back to town, and she sees the amazing power that Thea has had over Eilert Lovborg, Hedda's previous lover. And absolutely, it just does not sit well with her. She is desperate to have some sort of control.
And of course, that desperation, that jealousy drives her to do some incredible things that we'll leave it to our listeners to experience that for themselves. Say a quick word about how your cast has embraced this work, and maybe say a quick word about the crucial casting of the title role, which is one of the towering roles for any actress.
It has been referred to as the female Hamlet, not as a comparison to that particular character, but just the complexities of the play itself. And I knew going in, that if Hedda came across as mean, we were doomed. Because that's really interesting for about 5 minutes. Right. And then you're just watching a despicable person do despicable things because they're despicable. And I had no desire I wouldn't want to watch that. I certainly didn't want to direct it, but I wouldn't want to observe that as an audience member. And as an actor, I wouldn't want to be acting in something like that. So, you know, the good news is Parkside has an amazing group of young, developing artists that kept rising to the challenges of these auditions. The bad news is Parkside has an amazing number of really talented young artists that kept rising to it.
I'm so sorry.
I know. I mean, it's an embarrassment of
heck
riches.
Heck of a problem to have.
Absolutely. So, you know, we did the auditions, and then we did the callbacks, and I essentially was looking at two very viable casts. And then it came into, okay, well, what, you know, thinking about how these people interact, what they, you know, all of the picky stuff. How do they look together? How are they going to work together? How, you know, previous experiences with them and all that. Olivia Krause ended up with the role, not ended up with the role, earned the role. And I had previously directed Olivia in Book of Days the last time I directed for Parkside. That was a few years ago. And Olivia has this wonderful ability to take quote-unquote classical text and make them incredibly modern. incredibly contemporary, which is a double-edged sword, because actors who have that ability can very easily list into adding all sorts of modern expressions,
right?
Ums and you knows and things like that. But that's really fixable. You know, that's just, you just write them down and say, cut it out, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's something that was really appealing to me from a director point of view, was if you decide you are directing a classical piece of theater, I believe, you are doomed. Because suddenly you are dealing with something that is carved in stone and 1 to 400 years old, or 2,500 years old, or however.
Right.
And you're not acknowledging the fact that 100-some-odd years ago, for example, Hedda Gabler was a brand new play written by a revolutionary man who scared the pants off of society.
Right.
He was this dangerous little man with fabulous facial hair that was calling people out in a very public way, and calling institutions out in a very public way. So I wanted that sense of, this could have been written last week. That's really, and that's me as a director. That's also me as an actor. I don't want to play, you know, I don't want to sound pretty. I don't want to use my actor voice and you know, stand thusly and talk at my audience, even though the fourth wall is fully engaged, the separation between actors and audience.
Right.
There is no direct engagement with the audience. But the audience is right on top of us. My friend and colleague Jody Sikas wooed me with his set designs to have audiences on three sides. So and that front row is right there in the action.
Wow.
Which, again, I think that dynamic helps remind us that we are watching a piece of living theater. We're not watching something shaped out of porcelain.
Right.
That if we try to put
a
our hands on
ago.
It. Yeah, a long time ago. That if we touch it, it's going to shatter.
Right. I mean, it's not just porcelain, but ancient porcelain.
Exactly.
And antique.
Yeah. Yeah. Just look at it. Don't look. You know, don't touch it. Don't enjoy it. Don't learn anything from
it.
Just, ooh, it's Henrik Ibsen. Oh yes, Henrik Ibsen. Okay.
Yeah, like it's an object that sits on the shelf.
Exactly. And,
wow.
and that's death.
Right.
You know. And we've all seen those productions, and I've worked really hard, and so has my cast, to make sure this is not one of those productions. While and at the same time, honoring the old man, who I have a great affinity for, honoring his words, and honoring the world of the play.
Well, what a privilege to be able to experience a truly revolutionary work on the stage in what sounds like a very compelling production. So tell our listeners what they should do if they want to seek out tickets for
these
performances.
The dates of the performance are the 4th, 5th, 10th, 11th, and 12th, and all of those the time for all of those performances are 7:30. There's also a 10 a.m. matinee on the 11th. You can call the box office at 262-595-2564 or harass them online at uwparksidetickets.com.
Brian Gill is guest artist at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and the director of this production of Henrik Ibsen's Hedda Gabler. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we return to the topic that we explored yesterday, namely gender dysphoria and what that experience is like for the person themselves and for their loved ones. We heard on yesterday's program from the mother of someone experiencing gender dysphoria. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear from two different people. First, we'll replay a portion of the conversation I had last year with Alex John, transitioning from male to female. And we'll also hear from the parent of someone who was a student right here in the Kenosha Unified School District, once a boy, once a male, now female. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Cloudy and seasonal today with a little light snow, but very little, if any, accumulation, with a high of 33 degrees.